Kalorama, a Recorded Books High Bridge imprint, presents Let the People Rule: How Direct Democracy Can Meet the Populist Challenge by John G. Matsusaka. Read by Christopher Grove. Publisher's note: this audiobook refers to figures and tables included in the print and ebook editions of the book. Preface. More than two centuries ago, the founders of the United States launched an experiment to determine if ordinary people were capable of governing themselves. The results of that experiment have been immensely consequential for humankind, affirming the basic competence of common people and providing a powerful counterargument to those who would rule over others without their consent. That experiment continues to shape the modern world, and democracy has become the government of choice for free people across the globe. Yet today, many people feel that something has gone wrong, that government is drifting out of their control, its strings pulled by a shadowy elite. The people with these concerns are called populists, and their growing numbers are destabilizing the trajectory of many Western democracies and sending them off into uncharted waters. I wrote this book because I felt there was a view missing in contemporary discussions of populism and democracy, the view of the populists themselves. Public discussion of populism has been framed largely by elites who see it as an emotional reaction to changes in the world, an angry backlash, a temper tantrum that needs to be palliated. The populists' insistent complaint that government has drifted out of the people's control has been dismissed as a rationalization or simply ignored. As the book shows, however, the populists are onto something. There is good reason to believe that government has gradually slipped from popular control over the past century. I wanted to bring this view into the daylight and share the evidence that lends it credibility. Once we recognize that democracy is adrift, our entire approach to the challenge of populism changes. In the elite formulation, since the root problem is the excessive emotionality of the people, the solution is to transfer even more power from ordinary people, temperamental and irrational, to technocrats, judges, and other elites, cool-headed and analytic. They would address the shortcomings of democracy by having less democracy. Yet if the loss of popular control is not feeling but fact, a different tack is called for. I argue in this book that we should fix the problem by making government more democratic. To restore the connection between the people and government, let the people make more of the important public decisions themselves. Direct democracy. I am acutely aware that the idea of giving the people more power might seem counterintuitive to some listeners. Indeed, for those who were upset by the outcome of the Brexit referendum, or who disliked recent American referendums that legalized marijuana, allowed assisted suicide, or increased the minimum wage, it may seem absurd to turn over policy decisions to ordinary, potentially uninformed citizens. Of course, some listeners' intuitions may run the other way. They may find the idea of giving the people more of a voice an entirely natural extension of self-government. Either way, it is important to realize that those intuitions are simply that, intuitions. One of the book's goals is to sharpen and sometimes challenge those intuitions by exploring how referendums actually work in practice. Having been immersed in the study of direct democracy for three decades, and having examined it closely from many different angles, I have seen its good sides and its bad sides. Public discourse, however, tends to dwell primarily on the bad. Critics often cherry-pick the rich history of direct democracy, neglecting the broader picture of its successful operation in the United States and across the globe for a century or more. These criticisms of direct democracy tap into underlying apprehensions among Americans that I suspect stem from the fact that the United States is a global outlier, one of very few countries that has never held a national referendum, making it seem more far-fetched than it actually is. To allow interested listeners to form their own opinions, the chapters that follow describe what we know about direct democracy, its fascinating history, the rich scholarly literature about its use and influence, and a variety of evidence collected specifically for this book that will be new even to specialists. I have taken pains to describe everything in non-technical language, with technical details provided in footnotes for those listeners who want to see them. The book offers a path forward for democracy that is distinct from the ideologically driven solutions that are so common today. I have come to believe that our pervasive tendency to see the world through partisan lenses is a substantial part of our problem. The solutions advanced here resist placement on a conventional ideological spectrum. Giving the people more control of policy is not a liberal or conservative position, but an aspiration that spans the spectrum. Not everyone will reach the same conclusion about the merits of direct democracy, but I hope that by the end of this book it will seem, at the very least, like an idea worth more consideration than it has been given to date. Even better, I hope some might come to see referendums as a way to meet the challenges of populism and make our aspirations for self-government more of a reality. Democracy is drifting away from popular control, but we have the tools to bring it back. I have been thinking about these issues for several years, but the hard work on the book began in 2017 during a sabbatical at the University of Chicago's Stigler Center for the Study of the Economy and the State. I am grateful to Luigi Zingales, the center's director, for hosting my visit, for encouraging me to pursue the project, and generally twisting my arm to give a series of lectures in which I sketched out the framework of the book. My visit there was quite stimulating and led me to think more broadly about the questions that I originally anticipated. Discussions with faculty members and visiting scholars during my visit to the center were also important in developing my ideas. As I wrote the book, my colleagues at the University of Southern California were immensely helpful in allowing me to test-run arguments over lunch, coffee and dinner, and during workshops. No doubt they sometimes tired of hearing about it, but they never let on, and our wide-ranging discussions substantially sharpened the arguments. Many people informed my thinking, but I want to acknowledge by name several people who provided particularly helpful comments, discussions, or written feedback. Chris Berry, Odilon Camara, Janet King, Eckhart Kohler, Martin Levine, Anthony Orlando, Oz Ozbash, and Yanwei Wu. I received able research assistance from Artum Jukov and Elise Matsusaka. My editor at Princeton University Press, Bridget Flannery McCoy, made numerous contributions to every aspect of the manuscript: organization, structure, exposition, going well beyond the call of duty. I thought it was done when I gave her the first draft, but the version here is vastly different and, in my opinion, vastly superior, due to her patient questions, comments, and calls for revision, more accessible, clearer, and stripped of superfluous digressions. Finally, my largest debt in this book is to my wife Gia. Not only did she provide the usual moral support that spouses are supposed to provide, but she read every chapter in detail and gave me extensive feedback. Her comments, informed by both her PhD training and her years of professional business experience, led to changes in the tone, orientation, and quality of the arguments in every chapter of the book. For her consistent support through the ups and downs, there was never any question but that I would dedicate this book to her. Introduction. Democracy is ordinary people governing themselves. This type of government is the best we know, and has served us well for some time. Yet many today have the uneasy feeling that democracy is adrift, slowly slipping from popular control, carried by powerful undercurrents that we can only dimly perceive. In 2016, this long-simmering anxiety came to the surface in a string of unexpected populist election victories across the world. Donald Trump was elected President of the United States on a platform promising to drain the swamp. Democratic Socialist Bernie Sanders, running on a promise to make government work for everyone, not just the 1%, came close to taking the Democratic Party nomination from establishment favorite Hillary Clinton. British voters decided to leave the European Union. Populist parties did unexpectedly well in Austria, France, the Netherlands, and Poland. By 2018, populist parties controlled the government of 6 European countries and, through coalition agreements, had a hand in governing 6 others. While Trump and Sanders disagreed on just about every substantive policy, they shared a diagnosis about the root problem and what was needed to fix it. Our campaign is about representing the great majority of Americans, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, Conservatives, and Liberals, who read the newspaper or turn on the TV and don't hear anyone speaking for them. I declared my campaign for the presidency on the promise to give our government back to the people. Donald Trump. My hope is that when future historians look back and describe how our country moved forward into reversing the drift toward oligarchy and created a government which represents all the people and not just the few, they will note that, to a significant degree, that effort began with the political revolution of 2016. Bernie Sanders. Across the Atlantic, opponents of European integration sounded the same themes. The official slogan of the Brexit campaign was, "Take back control." As leading Brexiteer Nigel Farage saw it, "Because what the little people did, what the ordinary people did, what the people who have been oppressed over the last few years and seen their living standards go down, did. They rejected the multinationals, they rejected the merchant banks, they rejected big politics, and they said, actually, we want our country back. We want to be an independent, self-governing, normal nation." All of this rhetoric is textbook populism, an appeal to the people to take back their government from elites that have captured and subverted it. The identity of the elites varied with the speaker. For Trump, it was the swamp, a shadowy combination of government officials, lobbyists, media, and special interests entrenched in Washington, D.C. For Sanders, it was plutocrats and their corporate allies. In Europe, it was technocrats in Brussels and other supranational organizations. While the elites may have been different, the claim that the people were no longer in control was the same. This populist rhetoric was not conjured out of thin air. Politicians were retailing a message that voters already believed. Over the past 70 years, voters have grown increasingly skeptical about the responsiveness of government. Figure 1.1, based on the University of Michigan's long-running American National Election Studies, ANES, opinion survey, illustrates this trend. Since 1952, the ANES has asked people whether they agreed or disagreed with the statement, "People like me have no say in government." The figure shows the percentage of people who disagreed with the statement, and while there is some volatility, the downward trend is unmistakable. In 1952, only a small fraction of Americans felt left out by government. 87% of college-educated Americans disagreed with the statement, as did 65% of high school-educated Americans. Since then, public opinion has soured considerably. As of 2016, the worst year yet, only 35% of college-educated Americans and 25% of high school-educated Americans disagreed. We are now in a situation where a large majority of Americans, both more and less educated, believe they have no say in government. Disaffection is also high in Europe. A 2017 Gallup poll of the 27 European Union member states found that 57% of people had no confidence in their national government. Although Europe lacks a long-standing survey like the ANES, tracking public confidence in government, a major study of opinion in OECD, Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development Countries, combining a variety of different surveys, concluded that citizens in nearly all advanced industrial democracies have become increasingly skeptical toward politicians, political parties, and political institutions since the 1960s or 1970s, depending on the country. What explains the long downward slide in public confidence? Why do so many people feel they have lost control of the government? Two possible explanations dominate public debate. The economics view is that people are frustrated by the government's failure to shield them from economic dislocation caused by globalization, automation, and the changing demand for skills in the emerging information and technology industries. Looking at the United States, advocates of this view argue that the government has alienated ordinary Americans by catering to the economic winners, large financial institutions and big high-tech firms. Especially during the financial crisis when it bailed out big banks and corporations while watching impassively as ordinary people lost their jobs and homes. The cultural view is that people feel threatened by social and cultural changes associated with globalization and immigration, which they see as undermining their traditional beliefs and ways of life. The people do not see government as striving to stem the inflow of new people and ideas. To the contrary, they see it as actively promoting open borders, cultural change, and the importation of global social values. The debate between these two views is the subject of a rapidly growing, empirically sophisticated literature spanning economics, political science, and sociology. To assess the competing arguments, researchers look for statistical connections between support for populist candidates and a voter's exposure to economic or cultural shocks. For example, if a study shows that people who recently lost their jobs were more likely to vote for Trump, it supports the economics view. If it shows that people in communities with an influx of immigrants were more likely to vote for Brexit, it supports the cultural view. Both explanations enjoy some empirical support, but the literature shows no sign of converging to a consensus view, and neither explanation seems to account for the broader reality shown in Figure 1.1. The decline in public confidence is a long-running phenomenon, requiring a long-run explanation. It cannot be attributed primarily to recent economic shocks such as the Great Recession or recent surges in immigration. Moreover, both views see populism as a phenomenon involving less skilled and less educated citizens, which makes them hard to square with the fact that trust has deteriorated among both more and less educated people. If we want to understand the growth of populist sentiment, we need causes that have been at work for nearly a century and that affect citizens at all levels of education. One impediment to understanding, it seems to me, is the way this debate has been framed. When considering potential explanations, the one professed by the populists themselves has been largely ignored. The populists, as voiced by the politicians who represent them, say they are frustrated because the government is drifting out of their control and into the hands of elites. Yet contemporary discussion usually treats their words as a facade behind which hides the true explanation. The idea that the connection between the people and the government might be fraying, making the system less democratic, is dismissed out of hand. The first goal of this book is to take the populist argument on its own terms and seriously consider the possibility that government might well be slipping from popular control. Investigating this possibility leads down a variety of disciplinary paths into the terrain of political science, economics, history, and law, and involves examining published evidence as well as new data I have assembled specifically for this book. What emerges is a picture of the evolution of government over the past 100 years that lends support to populist claims. Stretching back a century, government in fact has become less responsive and less accountable to the people. A particularly intriguing part of the story is that loss of popular control came as an unintended consequence of a series of sensible changes in the structure of government. Disconnection has its roots in an increasingly complex world characterized by rapid technological change, globalization, and immense governments that citizens expect to address every important social and economic issue. To deal with these complications, governments have become increasingly reliant on experts to design and implement public policies. The heart of government was once the small group of elected legislators that passed the laws. It is now the immense technocratic bureaucracy that produces the flow of regulations that constitute most of what we call law today. The rise of the administrative state, which I chronicle in Chapter 1, has tilted the playing field in favor of corporations, industry groups, and other organized interests with the resources to monitor and influence bureaucratic decisions, while simultaneously making it difficult for ordinary citizens to understand and participate in the policy process. It has also empowered the unelected technocrats within the bureaucracies, giving them greater scope to pursue their personal policy interests. We cannot cure the problem simply by rewinding history and rolling back the administrative state. The factors driving the loss of control, growth of the administrative state, and reliance on experts were necessary responses to the growing complexity of the world. Reverting government to a simple pre-industrial form seems impossible, and would be unwise in any case. To find a solution, we need to think in terms of augmenting existing institutions, adding tools that allow more popular control, while maintaining a central role for technocratic expertise. Nothing would bring policy more directly under popular control than allowing the people to choose the policies themselves. This can be accomplished by cutting out the middlemen that cause the disconnection in the first place and holding votes on policy issues. In other words, referendums. Referendums are the best-known form of direct democracy, a term that contrasts with representative democracy, where the people's role is restricted to choosing their representatives. Referendums take many forms, from advisory votes called by governments, such as Brexit, to votes required by law, such as Ireland's vote on a constitutional amendment legalizing abortion, to votes on proposals drafted by citizens themselves, such as California's famous initiatives. All of these referendums are implemented through ballot propositions that give voters the option to indicate their position on a proposed law. The second goal of this book is to breathe new life into the old idea of using direct democracy to address the problem of democratic drift. During the populist and progressive eras a century ago, direct democracy featured prominently in public discussions. It was widely supported by civic leaders, journalists, academics, and leading politicians of both parties, including Presidents Theodore Roosevelt, Republican, and Woodrow Wilson, Democrat, as a way to restore popular control and curtail the power of special interests. From 1880 to 1920, states, cities, and towns across the country incorporated referendum procedures into their governing practices. As a result, the United States now makes extensive use of direct democracy at the state and local levels, more so than any other country, except for Switzerland. At the state level, for example, voters approve amendments to their state constitutions, vote on bond issues, repeal existing laws by petition referendum, and propose and approve new laws via the initiative process. At the local level, school districts in New York State hold votes on their annual budgets. Cities and counties in California require voter approval for tax increases. And cities and towns in Alaska, Arkansas, Kentucky, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Texas vote on whether to permit liquor sales. All told, over 99% of Americans vote directly on laws in their state or local governments from time to time. The populist and progressive movements ran out of steam before referendums reached the national level, when the world plunged into the Great Depression and then World War II. This left the country with a rich culture of direct democracy at the state and local levels and a complete dearth of referendums at the national level. The direct democracy deficit at the national level is not for lack of public interest. According to a 2017 Pew Research Center survey, 2/3 of Americans back the idea of voting directly on major national issues to decide what becomes law. And other surveys show that a majority in every American state favors letting citizens propose and approve state laws by initiative. The United States today finds itself as one of a dwindling group of democracies in the undemocratic position of never having held a national vote on a policy issue. Elsewhere, countries are increasingly utilizing referendums as a way to gauge public opinion on important policy issues. Prominent recent examples were the United Kingdom's 2016 vote to leave the European Union, Colombia's 2016 vote against a peace treaty with the FARC militia, and Ireland's 2015 vote to legalize same-sex marriage, and 2018 vote to legalize abortion. The idea of voting on important national issues enjoys majority support in all regions of the world. Europe, 70%. Asia, 67%. Africa, 64%. Latin America, 62%. And the Middle East, 60%. Since 1980, a majority of countries in all regions have held at least one national referendum, with the proportion of countries reaching 90% in Europe, Latin America, and Africa. Some of these referendums were held by authoritarian regimes and cannot be considered genuine exercises in democracy. But it nevertheless remains the case that many democracies are consulting their people directly on important national issues. All of this suggests that expanding the use of direct democracy does not require a heroic leap of faith. People are used to voting on policy issues, and we have a rich history across the globe that provides lessons in how to do it right. Explaining more concretely how this might be done so as to reduce democratic drift and how to capture the potential benefits while mitigating the risks is the third and final goal of this book. Giving people more control over policy decisions is the main attraction of direct democracy, but not the only one. A comparison of abortion policy in the United States and Italy points out another potential benefit. Abortion is one of the most divisive issues in the United States. Yet often lost in the polarized debates is the fact that ordinary Americans take a centrist view on the issue. Unlike those on the extreme left who assert that abortion should be permitted in all cases, most Americans believe that abortion should be prohibited in some circumstances, such as to select the sex of the child. And unlike those on the extreme right who believe that abortion should be banned in all circumstances, most Americans believe that there are situations in which it should be allowed, such as rape or when the health of the mother is at risk. As such, abortion has the appearance of a normal policy issue that could be resolved through standard democratic processes. A sizable, moderate group would be amenable to development of nuanced policies that balance a woman's right to choose against the value of prenatal life. The United States appear to be heading down the path of adopting.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?